All right, the first matter we have on calendar today is Van Horn versus the state. Council, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Ms. Conway?
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Audrey Conway, and along with the Clark County Public Defender's Office, I represent the appellant Richard Van Horn in this direct appeal from criminal convictions after a jury trial. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. The first issue I'd like to address with the court is whether the appellant's due process rights were violated when a preliminary hearing proceeded despite defense counsel's representations that her client was not in fact competent to proceed. Prior to the preliminary hearing in this case, the court ordered a competency evaluation. After being evaluated, Mr. Van Horn was found competent to proceed on March 10, 2011, although he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and an anxiety disorder. The preliminary hearing was set for April 5th, just under 1 month later. On that date, defense counsel advised the Justice of the Peace that Mr. Van Horn was unable to assist in his defense and was in fact unable to communicate with counsel in any meaningful fashion. As a result, she moved to continue the prelim for additional competency proceedings. The Justice of the Peace denied this motion, and after he was bound over, the district court also rejected the defense writ on this issue. Nevada law provides that any time after the arrest of a defendant, including without limitation proceedings before trial, if doubt arises as to the competence of the defendant, the court shall suspend the proceedings, as the case may be, until the question of competence is determined.
Counsel, answer that issue. I understand that competency is a fluid situation. However, there had been a finding of competency. My understanding indicates that the doctor who, or the individuals who reviewed, indicated that there was some issues as to communications, but that he was able to communicate. And counsel doesn't offer anything new. Why should we look at this issue?
Your Honor, the reason we should look at this issue is that the doctor's findings were valid and effective as of March 10th. The prelim was set almost a month later. And as Your Honor noted, competency is a fluid and dynamic type of thing. It can change over time. The older an evaluation is, the less credible it is.
Did counsel attempt to have the client re-examined?
Not at that moment, she did not. She made a record that during the preceding days leading up to the preliminary hearing, that her client's mental state had started to deteriorate. And the key issue for us is that under Dusky, competence is defined as the ability to understand the proceedings and to assist counsel in preparing the defense. The test to be applied must be whether the defendant has sufficient present ability to consult with his lawyer with a reasonable degree of rational
understanding. I understand that, but the record seems devoid of counsel making an adequate record to go to that point in light of what was laid down by the prior examining individuals, that it might not have been the most lucid statements coming back from the defendant, but the defendant was able to communicate.
Your Honor, our position actually is that the defendant was not able to communicate.
Why didn't the defense counsel waive up to district court and then have a competency hearing in district court?
What happened initially was that the case had gone to district court. He had been found competent, and the case came back down. She was actually making the record that she wanted further competency proceedings and would have waived up. But the Justice of the Peace insisted that the prelim go forth on that day.
Well, what about after the bindover? Was another competency hearing in district court?
No, at that point, Your Honor, and the record I think is clear on this, the issues had apparently resolved. Perhaps his meds kicked in and he improved his competency.
That makes it real tough for us. If, you know, what happens is because of that, it proved that the JP was right.
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because as we have noted, competency is not static. It's fluid. It's dynamic. So our position is that he was incompetent at the time of the prelim.
But wasn't there was a recess taken during the preliminary hearing? And after the preliminary hearing, the Justice Court came back indicating that the initial doctor's reports, in fact, noted moderately or severe stammering, but that Van Horn was otherwise alert and aware.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And what changed since that? I don't hear anything.
This is the specific record that counsel made when she moved to continue the prelim and she moved for further competency proceedings. She stated she had not had any meaningful conversations with her client about this case, that he was unable to communicate with her at all at that moment, that he would be unable to understand the testimony of the witnesses at the prelim.
What is she doing waiting until the preliminary hearing to do this? Why wasn't it done weeks before when she went to initially meet the client? Hi, I'm Michael Cherry. I'm your public defender. You're nuts. We're going to have you examined by a doctor.
That had already happened, and the doctors came back and said, right now he's not nuts, but he deteriorated. His condition deteriorated. He does have bipolar. He does have an anxiety disorder.
And so 2 days before the preliminary hearing or 5 days before the preliminary hearing, what was the story with the defense counsel?
He was struggling to communicate with him, hoping that he would improve. And on the day of the prelim, she realized that she could not even tell at that point whether he actually wanted to try to negotiate the case or whether he wanted to proceed with the prelim and then proceed to trial.
I think you ought to go on to another argument.
Okay, Your Honor. Will do. The next issue I would like to discuss with the court is the issue of the client's confession. It's our position that the record reveals that there was, in fact, here an invocation of his Fifth Amendment right to silence. Approximately 10 minutes and 10 seconds into the interview, Mr. Van Horn invoked his right to silence by stating, "I'm sorry, sir, I don't want to say any more to you." Now, admittedly, the transcript contains blanks. Throughout the entire transcript, there's a series of blanks, and in fact, on the statement, there's a series of blanks. So defense counsel produced to the trial court an amplified recording so the court could pick up on the statement, as well as this written interpretation. The defense submitted this at the hearing on the motion to suppress, and when he was again pressured to speak to officers, Mr. Van Horn said, "I already told you," asked for more time to think, and refused to answer certain questions. Under the Ninth Circuit case, Heard versus Terhune, the law does not require a defendant to do any more than to say that he has nothing to say. Mr. Van Horn did exactly that, but detectives refused to honor this invocation of his right to silence. Courts have construed statements similar to "I'm not saying anything" as sufficient as an invocation of the right to silence. The Ninth Circuit has construed the statement "I'm not going to get all off into that, and that's all I can say" as sufficient invocations of the Fifth Amendment right. The state relies on Maestas versus State and argues that in this case, as in Maestas, Mr. Van Horn's invocation was not unambiguous. This court, however, found in Maestas that although the defendant initially said he wanted to remain silent, in the very same breath, he also admitted that he alone committed the crimes, which distinguishes the instant case. The officer then asked Maestas that he wanted to know if Maestas wanted to tell them how this all came about, to which Maestas responded, "I really don't know." The interrogating officer then stated, "Why don't you start from the beginning?" And Maestas then explained in detail his involvement in the crimes. Thus, it's our position that the detectives in Maestas were faced with a far more equivocal invocation of the Fifth Amendment right to silence, in light of the fact that Maestas invoked his right in the very same sentence as discussing the actual facts of the case and implicitly admitting some culpability in the facts of the case. Further, in Maestas, the officers actually acknowledged this invocation in a fashion that did not happen with Mr. Van Horn, because officers immediately then asked Mr. Maestas whether he wanted to talk to them, which again distinguishes the instant facts. Then Maestas answered that second inquiry far more equivocally than our client, because Maestas stated that he didn't know if he wanted to talk, but continued to commence the discussion of incriminating facts. It's also our position that the actual confession was involuntary for several reasons. It's our position that the detectives used implicit promises of lenience to elicit these incriminating statements from our client. In Arizona versus Fulminante, the United States Supreme Court held that the defendant's own confession is probably the most probative and damaging evidence that can be admitted against him. Because these admissions come from the actor himself, the most knowledgeable and unimpeachable source of information about his past conduct. In Pisano versus State, this court enunciated the totality of the circumstances test. It is our position that in this case, Mr. Van Horn experienced several of these factors that should have resulted in a finding of involuntariness.
Doesn't the record reflect contrary?
The detective, in fact, indicated to him that this is something where you're not going to get probation.
He said both. He did at one point say, this is something where you're not going to get probation.
Right.
But he undermined that clear, accurate, and unequivocal statement by suggesting subsequently that if only Mr. Van Horn would subject himself and successfully pass a barrage of polygraphs, then probation could be an option for him, which, as we're all aware, is completely incorrect. That was the kind of implicit promise of leniency that, in our position, we view as rendering this confession completely involuntary. Because Mr. Van Horn, at that point, was misled into thinking that perhaps this detective could assist him in achieving a more favorable outcome, but only if he confessed. Detectives implied that if only he were honest with them, he would receive lenience in the system. And I quote, you get caught, you're honest, people tend to be lenient on you. He returned to this theme subsequently and implied that a confession would result in lenience, that his honesty would have a significant impact on his case, and that he would have little chance of probation without a full confession in this case.
What about the Loomis convictions? There's four of them. I'm troubled by two of them. What do you think about that?
It's our position that several of the Loomis convictions were really incidental to the other conduct, and also that the testimony was not specific enough to justify these convictions. That this is the kind of case where the testimony at times was vague and was ambiguous and certainly did not suffice to meet the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Unless this court has any other questions, I would reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Burton?
Let me start with where I left off with the Loomis convictions. There's four Loomis convictions. Of course, there's five sexual assault convictions, too. Do you want to defend all four Loomis convictions, or are you ready to concede to them?
Your Honor, the state would stand by all four of the Loomis convictions, as well as all five of
the... Tell me about them, then. Lay them out all four.
Certainly, Your Honor. In this case, the defendant was initially charged with five counts of sex assault.
They don't talk about sex assault. Talk about the lewdness.
I apologize, Your Honor. He was charged with 12 counts of lewdness. Five of those were associated with the sex assault counts. They were subsequently vacated at sentencing. The other four were related to acts that he perpetrated on the young victim in this case, where he touched her breast, rubbing it in a circular motion both over and under her clothing, and touched her vagina as she was performing fellatio, or before or after she was performing fellatio, but during these acts of fellatio. She testified that he touched her breasts on at least 3 to 5 occasions. In closing argument, the state told the jury that they could essentially give the defendant the benefit of the doubt, that they had charged him originally with five charges of lewdness in relation to him touching the breasts of the young victim. The jury did that and only convicted him of 3. As to the vaginal touching, the jury convicted of 1 count and did not convict him of another count. So that's where we have...
Let me ask you this. Her statement, she made one statement that indicated that he touched her breasts and her genitals. The other statement as to the time between other touchings, there was nothing specific. There was nothing indicated that was particularly specific. It was a very general statement that this has happened before.
That's correct, Your Honor, and it was after her testimony as to when the sex assaults happened. So it was in the context of her testifying as to when the sex assaults happened, a couple of months before she turned 10 to October of 2012 when they were discovered by Officer Menino. Then the question is about, did he ever touch you during this time period as opposed to you performing fellatio on him? And that's the context that we have of the time span. And she testifies that it was during these acts of fellatio or as they were going through, I believe she testified one was in the house itself, in the kitchen, he touched her on her breast.
Same time he was doing fellatio?
Your Honor, my recollection of her testimony is that it's unclear. It's unclear if that was during the actual fellatio itself or if this was a separate event.
Does unclear mean the same thing as vague? I'm just curious because I heard Ms. Connolly say the word vague. You're saying the word unclear, and I'm just trying to coordinate these these words?
Certainly, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that it's ambiguous because there is certain testimony that she conducted or performed fellatio on the defendant in the kitchen. She also testifies, to my recollection of the record, that she was touched on her breast by the defendant in the kitchen. She never testifies one way or another or is asked a question one way or another as to whether that was happening at the time of the fellatio or not. And again, that's my recollection of the record.
What about the request for the continuance of the preliminary hearing because of instability?
Certainly, Your Honor. And I think on this issue, the record belies the defendant's claim of being incompetent at the time of the preliminary hearing. As counsel pointed out, he was deemed competent a month before after being analyzed by a psychologist and a psychiatrist. Both of them noted that he claimed to suffer from bipolar disorder and that he was not being medicated for that condition at that time.
But this is a fluid situation.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Conditions change.
That's fair. And so I'm simply setting up the context. So he says, they say, despite the fact that he has not been medicated with for his bipolar disorder, he is nonetheless competent, but we think it's a good idea for him to be medicated. So he's then sent back to CCDC, and he's medicated. That's the only thing that has changed from the time he's deemed competent to the time of the preliminary hearing.
The counsel has asserted, and the counsel has every right to be able to communicate with their client. And they indicated they couldn't communicate with their client. That's what's been alleged.
That's correct, Your Honor. And what I would argue is that a claimed inability to communicate alone is insufficient to determine that
It's easy to say it's claimed if it's the other side. If it was you and you claimed that you couldn't communicate with one of your people, wouldn't you think that's a valid statement?
Well, the reason I say claimed is because the record belies the claim.
Did the court ask any questions of the defendant to see if they could communicate with him on that occasion?
They did. They briefly canvassed the client. But what I'm talking about when I say belied by the record is that during a break, when the court looks at the medical records, calls CCDC to confirm that the defendant is taking his prescribed medication, the prosecutor...
Also, the question, as we look at the progeny of cases that come down to this question, deal with present ability to communicate, not past.
And what I'm saying,
the position the court has taken is asking, what is the present situation? I asked that question of counsel, so I'm asking that question of you. Quite candidly, the court doesn't need a lecture as to what it means since this court wrote that opinion.
Thank you, Your Honor. I apologize. What I'm saying is that during the break, the state noted that the defendant was able to communicate with his attorney about the amended criminal complaint that was being filed. Furthermore, during the testimony of the preliminary hearing itself, the state noted that he overheard the defendant talking to his counsel about certain parts of the testimony. He made that record after the conclusion of evidence. So we have here a claimed inability to communicate that is belied by the record at the present time, at the time of the preliminary hearing, as stated in the record by the fact that the defendant was able to communicate with his attorney about the amended criminal complaint, as well as about specific portions of the testimony that was overheard, not as an effort to eavesdrop by the prosecutor, but simply as the matter of dynamics of a courtroom, was able to overhear questions that he was asking and statements that the defendant was making to his attorney. We also have the fact that just a week after the preliminary hearing, when he's arraigned at the district court, there's no question of his competency. There's no issue raised as to his competency. As furthermore, the petition for writ of habeas corpus proceedings, there's no question that the defense at that time says he is absolutely competent at this time.
So it sounds like almost that there was some type of waiver because best practices would be just because your client's bound over doesn't mean the next day you can't have a doctor or a psychiatrist or a psychologist see your client. And it seems like this public defender didn't think it's necessary.
And that's certainly one of the state's arguments. And specifically, the district court denied the petition for writ of habeas corpus without prejudice and gave counsel an opportunity to further investigate the effects of any medication that the defendant might have been on, the time that it takes to get up to workable levels so that he could be, in counsel's opinion, competent to stand trial. And that further diligence was never pursued by counsel on that point. And so we have here a situation where the record belies the claims and there's a fluid competency throughout the proceedings.
How about the confession? What do you think about that as far as, is there a constitutional problem with the confession?
No, Your Honor, and I would say that this is very clearly within the line of Maestas, where Maestas says, I would like to invoke know, I'd like to take the silence, but I did do this alone. And in this situation, we have the defendant speaking with the detectives for 10 minutes before he makes some vague, and this is the words of the district court, some vague assertion of his right. The response by the detective is, okay, and then the defendant continues immediately with that to talk more about.
It was equivocal. It was an equivocal.
That's what the district court found, correct.
Counsel, how do you respond to the argument that was put forth this day about the conversation? We get the beginning that parts of the statements back from the defendant were inaudible. Counsel has represented that they have enhanced that recording and it's a little more clear. Is there not an absolute prohibition of continuing once the party makes that representation? But having said that, what is your position as to this conversation and whether or not he attempted to invoke or, from the state standpoint, did not invoke?
Our position, as noted in our respondent's answering brief, is after listening to, and it's actually an amplified copy of the amplified copy of the audio that was provided to the district court. The district court listened to that. He listened to the audio as unamplified. He listened to the video. He looked at the transcript. He looked at a modified version of the transcript, and he determined that it was an ambiguous vague assertion of a right that was equivocal at best. And that's, quite honestly, looking at it in the light most favorable to the defendant. And so looking at it from, again, the standpoint of the officer, is it reasonable for him to, after listening to the person in person, who the state does not dispute has a speech impediment, has a stammer, make some vague assertion that's equivocal? His response is, okay, and then the defendant immediately continues to talk and recommence talking with the detective about, at that point, his lack of involvement in the crimes. I would actually also argue that at some point the detective is saying there's not going to be an admission here. He gets up to leave, and he determines as he's walking out that the defendant wants to continue talking. So we don't have an occasion where the defendant is looking to end the conversation, but instead asks for the detective to stay to continue with the conversation. And then we have the subsequent confession and admissions that were admitted at the trial. Your Honor, with the...
I'm partially unclear because I'm wondering now if you're conceding the fact that he invoked him. They're attempting to say that he waived by wanting to continue with the conversation.
And I apologize if there's any confusion. Our position is that there was no clear invocation of a right to remain silent, and that is borne out by his subsequent statements, both immediately after his vague assertion of his right, as well as just within the context of the conversation itself.
And the judge's ruling pertained to the equivocal nature of the invocation as opposed to any waiver.
That's correct, Your Honor. He found the assertion that defense now claims was an invocation of right to be ambiguous and a vague assertion of the right. Okay. With the time remaining, I would like to talk about the jury instructions in this case and point out two very important points that might not be borne out in the briefing itself. The first is that when we're talking about statutory sexual seduction as a lesser included offense and the appellant's request to have that as a lesser offense, they did not ask for that as a lesser offense or an instruction on a lesser offense as to all of the counts of sexual assault. They only asked for it as to count one, which would have been the fellatio witnessed by Officer Medina. Their strategy or their theory of the case was that there was no way, essentially, that they could deny that that happened. So they were going to argue that it was consensual. The other four counts of sexual assault, they argued a theory of defense of credibility of the witnesses, that they never happened. And so we have a sex assault being charged five times with a lesser included, only requested as to count one. The other point that I would like to make is that the defense was not precluded from arguing consent. They were precluded from arguing and requesting that the jury find the defendant guilty of statutory sexual seduction, but they were able and did argue that all of the acts, or actually specifically count one, was consensual. And in their closing argument, were able even to argue that there was some other uncharged offense that the defendant was guilty of, but that the state overcharged in this case and that this was not sexual assault because it was consensual. Our stance is that statutory sexual seduction is not a lesser included of sexual assault because there are ways in which to commit the crime of sexual assault without committing the crime of statutory sexual seduction. And in light of this court's opinions in Barton and Jackson, the elements test that is adopted in Blockberger is the test. So we look at the elements, not the facts of the case. So the fact that in this case, with these facts, there could be an argument that statutory sexual seduction was also or alternatively committed is not part of the analysis.
Is this more of a case of related versus included?
And Your Honor, to that I would state that this court has rejected lesser related offenses or that the defense is entitled to lesser related offenses. And so to that extent, I suppose that's correct, but that they're not entitled to jury instructions on lesser related offenses. That they are entitled to lesser included, but that statutory sexual seduction is not a lesser included offense.
And then the elements that you're looking at to make that distinction are essentially the age element?
The age of the defendant in this case specifically, as statutory sexual seduction requires that the defendant be over the age of 18, where sexual assault of a person under the age of 14 has no such requirement. There's also, in sexual assault, the ability to, it includes other penetration, whereas statutory sexual seduction, it's a subsection B of statutory sexual seduction that covers other penetration, and it has to be done with the specific intent of arousing the sexual desires of either party. So it's possible to commit the act of sexual assault with digital penetration or object penetration without the specific intent of doing so with the intent to arouse the sexual desires of either party. Sexual assault also applies to instances where a party is forced or against their will to perform acts of bestiality, which is not covered by statutory sexual seduction. Your Honor, with that, the state asks that you affirm.
All right. Any other questions? Nope. All right. Thank you. Okay, Ms. Conway, you got about 4 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. Initially, just to briefly return to the preliminary hearing issue. The court did inquire as to whether Mr. Van Horn was canvassed at all by the Justice of the Peace. In fact, he was very briefly canvassed in that he was asked if he understood the proceedings, to which his answer was no. However, the court did not find that compelling enough to warrant the decision to grant the defense request. It's our position that the state's citation to the fact that the district attorney saw some conversations occurring, the court saw some conversations occurring between counsel and her client, and the district attorney may, in fact, have overheard some of the content of those conversations. It's no different than in Ferguson when the trial judge noted that before defense counsel showed up to court, the trial judge had had numerous conversations again with Mr. Ferguson. However, that did not prevent this court from finding that defense counsel's request for a competency proceeding and defense counsel's representations that her client was not competent still warranted overturning the trial court. And the reason why is that these facts are very similar to Olivares versus State, where the court found an abuse of discretion in the denial of the motion for competency proceeding. When defense counsel makes these representations, under Medina versus California, the U.S. Supreme Court noted that a defendant's inability to assist counsel can in and of itself constitute probative evidence of incompetence. Defense counsel will often have the best informed view of the defendant's ability to participate in his own defense.
But ultimately, it's the district court or the judge's determination, was it? And I take it, based on the argument back and forth, the court was fully apprised of those conversations as well as the defense's position.
Only to the extent that the court could have been fully apprised in that nobody heard the actual details of the conversation except for the defense attorney herself, and it was her position that her client was not able to understand the proceedings. When she pursued that writ, she took the position that he still had been unable to rationally understand what was going on and unable to assist in his defense under Dusky.
But it sounds like we would have this moving situation where she begins with, he's not competent. During these preliminary hearings, we have these side conversations. We have this statement back to the court as to what was allegedly overheard. The defense reaffirmed the position that I don't know what they think they heard, but this was not.
Absolutely. Yes. Defense counsel did say, I don't know what they think they heard, but whatever they heard, first of all, was privileged communications between myself and my client. Second of all, the fact that she may have been explaining some of the amendments to the complaint to the client or explaining what was basically going on and he may have had some questions, it still doesn't necessarily mean that it met Dusky. It still doesn't mean that he was able to assist in his defense. This court held in Olivares that evidence is substantial if it raises a reasonable doubt about the defendant's competency to stand trial, and once there is such evidence from any source, there is a doubt that cannot be dispelled by the resort to conflicting evidence, and that's exactly what happened here.
But the Justice Court, go ahead, Justice Chair. Go ahead. The Justice Court, I thought, found specifically that no continuance was necessary because of the situation. I think there was the words that were used. The situation was essentially the same. His competency.
The Justice Court did think that the defendant's affect, while being somewhat different at that moment right before the prelim, still did not warrant the finding that he was potentially incompetent, relying also on the medical evaluations that had been done a month previous and relying on statements from the nurse at the jail that as far as she knew, he was still taking his meds. But of course, it's our position that all of that conflicting evidence pales in light of the defense attorney's compelling, contemporaneous, specific, and detailed statements that he could not assist in his defense and that he could not understand the proceedings. It's our position that at that moment, all proceedings should have been suspended and additional competency proceedings should have occurred.
Well, all this happened on the day of preliminary, right?
On the day of
preliminary. Nothing happened before, nothing happened after. Now, it would be a much stronger case. You have to admit, best practices of my old office, the public defender's office, would have been to do something before or after. Nothing was done.
If we had had him evaluated and had a written psychologist finding to add to that motion, but it remains our position that defense counsel's representations are still the best evidence, and under Dusky, when you're looking at whether somebody can assist in his own defense and whether he understands, but what we're really talking about here is, do we not believe defense counsel? Do we think that she may have some reason?
You go back and you say, you know what, let's not just do it the day of preliminary. Let's do it maybe in an emergency motion 2 days before, and let's have a doctor see him the day afterwards.
But again, because his situation is so fluid and so dynamic, it changes. He literally could have been competent the day before, but the point is when she walked in to conduct that prelim, he wasn't. That is where we believe the due process violation occurred, and unless this court accepts the fact that, you know, justice courts can discount the representations of defense counsel and allow a potentially incompetent defendant to proceed to prelim, then we won't have a due process problem.
I like my analysis better.
Counsel, thank you. We appreciate the fine briefs and the excellent arguments today by both of you, and this case will stand submitted.